those searchlights up on the tower. Right now. Move! Move!
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
Good morning, this is Community Spotlight. I'm Herb, and each week I try and bring somebody in to talk about their journey or event or a community organisation here in Armidale. And this morning I have Bruce Woolley. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Herb. How are you?
I'm very good. Bit of a cloudy day today and some rain expected, which is fantastic for Armidale. We've been very dry just recently.
Terrible.
So let's start with this. Can you confirm or deny the following for me? Are you the same Bruce Woolley that in 1978 co-wrote the song Video Killed the Radio Star, ranked at number 18 for 2 weeks on the Canada Chum chart in 1980?
You got that from ChatGPT, which is one of the reasons you shouldn't trust AI. There is another Bruce Woolley. I wish I were him, because I'd be a hell of a lot richer.
All right, then. So let's chat about you and your journey to Armidale. Where were you born?
I was born in 1956 in Maryborough in Queensland. My parents had moved there from... Mum had been born in Moolumbah and Dad in Ipswich, and they had gone to Maryborough for Dad to take up a job with British Paints, actually. And then I was born, and then my sister was born two years later, and we moved back to Brisbane for Dad to take up another job.
Girls?
Girls. In Brisbane, I went to the Sherwood State School. After that, in grade six, I moved over to the Church of England Grammar School, as it was called then, otherwise known as Churchy to Queenslanders. It's now the Anglican Church Grammar School.
So what was childhood like in Queensland?
Well, for me, it was perfect. My parents were, you know, really loving and terrific, and I don't remember any real problems. I broke an arm at one point from walking on the fence in the rain, and I had been told beforehand not to, but hey, that happens to every kid, I think.
Testing the boundaries?
Yes, probably.
Like most children. Now tell me, and I ask this question on everybody, you went in for a long career in journalism and broadcasting, which we'll get into, but what was it in your childhood, maybe 8 to 12, that put you on that path, do you think?
I remember very clearly that my parents were news fanatics. Dad used to get every newspaper that was available delivered in the mornings and the afternoons. And I remember all four of us lying in their big king-size bed, and they would be reading the news sections and the opinion sections, and then we'd be handed the cartoons and other things from the newspaper that we might be interested in. But I gradually grew to want to know more about the news, and I had that warm, cozy feeling that this was something that families did. So that gave me, I guess, the emotional background for being a journalist.
Put you on the path.
Yes.
So university, now you started off in medicine.
Yeah, I got the marks to get into medicine, and I thought, well, you know, I should try at least. And I did the first year and absolutely hated it. And my marks reflected that. But I was able to switch from medicine into a Bachelor of Arts with journalism and political science majors. And I was so much happier. The irony is that I got to the last semester of the three-year degree and got a cadetship with the ABC. So I didn't finish two of my subjects in that degree either. I did at the age of 46, though, in Canada.
So, ABC Brisbane, what was your role in ABC Brisbane? For 13 years, was it?
I was with the ABC for a total of 13 years. I was a cadet for the first year at ABC in Brisbane in the news department. And then I moved over to the talks department, which is a radio lunchtime show. And then from there, I joined predecessor to the 7:30 program, which was called Nationwide. That was doing mini documentaries and studio interviews and, you know, political reporting, basically.
So just tell me about getting a cadetship. What does a cadet do? So if somebody was interested in getting into journalism, and I'm assuming it probably hasn't changed a lot, except the online content, what does a cadet do in journalism?
It's basically an apprenticeship. You learn from the best of the people around you, and I think it's the best way to learn, actually. You have to do everything, and I can tell you a story. One of the overnight shifts that you do, because you're the cheapest person to put on the overnights, you call the police every hour and you ask them what's going on, and usually the answer is nothing. But I can remember being traumatized at one point because I called and they said, yes, there's been a plane crash on the Barrier Reef. Light aircraft has flown into some power lines between islands, and And I said, oh, okay, so I'll write a story about that. And they said, yeah. In the second hour, they said, we've identified the pilot. His name was Cameron Richard Gordon. And so I wrote the story about that. And then an hour after that, after I'd published the name, I realized that Cameron Richard Gordon was a guy that I learned to fly with in the... I had a flying scholarship from the Air Force, and so did he, and we were good mates. And here was I reporting about him and just not recognizing the name.
I think I've actually heard of similar other reporters that have had the same experience.
Mm.
So it's probably something that does happen quite often.
Well, it's interesting. There's such a thing called vicarious trauma, and that is when you're not necessarily involved in a terrible accident yourself, but you see enough of it so that 59% of journalists end up with post-traumatic stress disorder, whether they're just working in a newsroom and writing stories or whether they're actually out on the road covering terrible disasters.
Right, I can understand that perfectly. Then you went 4 years to London, but you had a trial by fire when you first arrived. Tell me about that.
Yes, the week that I arrived, they put me in a little hotel around the corner from the ABC's building in Portland Place, and I was up about three or four stories, no elevator, and the phone rang, and the phone was down in the foyer on the ground floor, and it kept on ringing and ringing, and finally somebody else answered it and called up to me and said, you're wanted. And I went down, and it was the ABC in Sydney saying, a bomb has just gone off in the Grand Hotel in Brighton, and you need to get down there. Turned out it was an attempt by the IRA to kill the entire British cabinet. And in fact, they killed five people, and I think there were 30 major injuries, and coverage lasted for days.
That was in Margaret Thatcher's.
Yes, it was the Thatcher cabinet that they were trying to get rid of. And so that was my introduction to being a foreign correspondent.
So was there much difference in the ABC in London than the ABC in Brisbane?
Well, the major difference is that you're on the other side of the world in terms of time. In Brisbane, you're reporting on something that just happened on the next newscast. In London, you've got half the day to consider all of the sources and check out all of the information and then write your story so that it's happening and being played in Australia the morning after, which is actually the night time there. So just getting that into your head is takes a little bit of time.
So a lot of long nights and burning the candle.
Yeah, it's very tiring, in fact. But it was I was lucky that I was not married at that point.
So then you moved to Canada for a six-week contract with CBC.
Yeah, at the end of my term in London, or just before I finished, I'd met a Canadian and we got married and then decided that the next step for us would be to move to Canada and live there and work there. And I had a friend who was the executive producer of CBC Television News in Toronto. And he said, look, I can give you a six-week contract, but you've got to come straight away and I can't guarantee anything beyond that. So I said, yeah, sure. I was 30 and I thought, this is a big break. And I went there and I loved it. It was like learning the great detail of how to be a reporter compared with just learning the basics in Australia. They had so much more money. The ABC at the time was a $500 million organization. The CBC at the time was over $1 billion. And broadcasting in French and English, just incredibly capable and winning awards all over the world.
So just go back to that trauma, I suppose. Now tell me about in November 1985, the incident in Malta, hijacking.
Mm.
So where were you? Where were you located in 1985?
I was in London and in a lovely little two-bedroom apartment around the corner from Marble Arch. And I got a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning from the foreign desk in Sydney saying, you've got to be on the next plane to Malta. As a foreign correspondent, you've always got a bag packed so that you can go. So I got to the airport without knowing very much about it. It turned out some Abu Nidal Palestinian terrorists had hijacked the plane. It was supposed to fly from Athens to Cairo, but they hijacked it and they wanted it to fly to Libya. But it didn't have the fuel to get there. So it had to land, and they made it land in Malta, and then they ran it down to the end of the runway and stopped it there and closed the runway. We were in one of the last flights that was allowed to land after them, and I had arrived with the BBC's foreign correspondent, David Willey, and he and I had worked out on the plane how we would work together and get this done. We thought we were the only people covering this story at that time, but the plane came to land, and we saw on the side of the runway four Learjets, all with satellite dishes pointing at the sky, and that was the American networks, and they had already arrived, and they were already doing live coverage. So it was hard to get an exclusive under those circumstances.
We don't need to go into it too far, but it was very traumatic what was happening in front of your eyes. How did you deal with sort of the trauma of seeing people being executed, I suppose?
Yeah, it was. It really does take it out of you. It was the worst experience I've had. I've never been a war correspondent. I've never seen fighting close up. But in the end, there were 60 passengers and crew who were killed in that event because Egyptian paramilitary SAS-type people boarded the plane and they started throwing around hand grenades. And that set fire to the plastics on the plane. And so if you have a look at the photographs that are still online, you can see how much damage has been done to the plane itself. And they got a few people out, but, it was a disaster.
Horrendous. Mm. So, on a brighter note, Rachel, when did you meet Rachel, your wife?
Well, she and I had both divorced. We were living in Canada in a little place called Stratford, Ontario, which is a theatre town. Rachel had been working for the theatre, and then she was general manager of Stratford Summer Music Festival. And she had sent me an invitation, because I was working at the CBC television at that time. She said, "Would you like to come to our VIP event on the island in the middle of the river?" And so I called to say thank you, yes, I'd like to. And then I recognised the Australian accent. We had a little chat and then I hung up. And then I called back and I said, "I'm having a dinner party on Friday night. Would you like to come?" And she said, "Yes, sure." And then I had to call around and get friends to come to a dinner party on Friday night.
You fox.
Yes, indeed. But it worked. We've been married 20 years this year.
Two bright minds met. Now, you returned to Australia in 2007, take up another posting with ABC.
Yes, I applied for a job because we just got sick of the cold. It was minus 20 when we'd made the decision to come back to Australia somehow. And I applied to the ABC. There was a job as the manager for ABC Far North Queensland, and I managed to get that. So we went from minus 20 to plus 30 and 100% humidity in Cairns, and that was a bit of a shock to the system. But I was there for 2.5 years and then got promoted to a position called day editor of ABC News Current Affairs in Brisbane.
So just go back a step. In Canada, you finished off to your journalism degree.
Yes.
By correspondence.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was an open university thing. I called the University of Queensland and I said, "Look, I've got two subjects to do and I've got the time to do it now. What do you reckon?" And they said, "Yeah, sure, do these two subjects and, you know, we'll grant you the degree." So it took me 6 months and I got them done. And the funny thing was, because I later went into academia, I could not have taken that career step without having any sort of degree behind me. So it was sheer luck.
That's kismet.
Yes, indeed.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely kismet. So, yes, you went into academia in 2011 with the University of Queensland. Tell me about that.
Well, it became the job that I wish I'd been able to do my entire life. I just loved it. But, of course, I couldn't have taught anything because I wouldn't have known anything if I'd gone into academia straight out of uni. So what I brought to it was 33 years of experience in broadcast journalism. I initially, when I retired from the ABC in July of 2011, I was 55 and I was burnt out. And I contacted a friend of mine, Leo Bowman, who was a professor at QUT, and I said, "You know, have you got any small jobs in teaching?" And he gave me one subject to do, which was 1 hour a week. And the following week, it turned into 40 hours a week. And 6 months later, I was full-time employed by the University of Queensland teaching broadcast journalism. So it's a career change that was unexpected in a way, but which just seemed to fit me perfectly.
Well, I think even back a few years, my wife and I were talking about our kids, and some of the employment or career advice was that most people will have a career, one or two or three different changes throughout their whole life.
Yeah, that's very true. And the other thing that I read was a Harvard Business Review report years ago that said 3 years is about the right amount of time to be in a job, because the first year you're learning, and so they're paying you to learn. The second year you're cruising because you know how to do it. And the third year you're starting to feel a bit touchy and wanting to move on. And I found that even though I was 20 years at the CBC, I moved every 3 years from one department to another or one show to another. So I think, you know, you don't want to get bored in the position you're in.
So just one of those, so being not bored, in the University of Queensland, you basically set up an international learning program for students, and you did trips through India, Vietnam and Indonesia. Why did you do that?
Well, there was a program called the New Colombo Plan that provided money if you could make a case to take students overseas or bring overseas students to Australia, then they would cover the costs. So I put in an application and we got it, and then we kept on getting it semester after semester. So twice a year I would take a group of 10 to 20 students overseas, depending on how much money we were given, to learn how to be foreign correspondents and to make their own productions so that, for instance, in the very first one we did, the students' television reports were used by this ABC News breakfast program. As you know, we managed to file it back via the internet to them, and then they ran it in the morning. So those kids would never have got that sort of exposure without this.
Well, I think learning by doing is a very important part of the way we as humans learn how to do stuff.
And that was the subject of my research related to this. It was work integrated learning, which is learning on the job, learning how to do something. And, you know, when you think about it, it became something that I wrote a thesis about, signature pedagogy. And so what signature pedagogy is if you're studying to be a doctor, the signature pedagogy subject is going to be surgery, actually being a doctor, cutting something out. If you're a lawyer, the signature pedagogy is the moot court case, where you learn to speak in court and argue and debate. And I argued that signature pedagogy for journalism is doing journalism. And so these overseas courses were to prove the point that you have to do it to become good at it.
Makes perfect sense to me, Bruce. You were given in 2017 the UQ Teaching Excellence Award, but prior to that you'd actually received awards for your journalism. Yet I think I've got the Australian Journalist Association, the New York Festivals, gold and silver medals, and the Best of Festival Grand Award. You must have been pretty good at your craft.
I hope so. One of the things that the CBC gave me was the opportunity to create, to do something brand new. So when I was in CBC News Radio, I created a program called The World This Weekend, which was half an hour every Saturday night and Sunday night. And it was quite different from a regular newscast. It was news, business, arts, sports and weather in a half-hour package. But it was all interactive and all live. And it changed every half hour, every hour, from one side of the country to the other. That ended up winning a New York Festivals Award for, it was a silver medal, so second prize, but in the category of World's Best News Magazine. The other New York Festival Award I did, I worked as a producer with another producer, Barbara Saxberg, who was brilliant, and we used sound from that year, I think it was 1992, from war zones around the world, and our correspondents actually reporting from these places. But instead of interviewing them about what happened, we used actuality, the sound of them at events reporting. And for example, one of our correspondents was Joan Leishman in South Africa, and she was attending a funeral after a riot that had killed lots of black people. And she was hugging one of the women who had lost her husband, and she said, her tears ran down my cheeks.
Very poignant. So we might just go to Armidale. You're lucky enough to call Armidale your home.
Yes.
For how long now?
We arrived on the 16th of January 2025. So 16 months, 18 months, something like that.
18 months. I've got the story from Rachel, your wife, about how you came here, but I want to hear it from your memory.
Right.
How you came here. What was the process or the points that happened to make you decide to come to Armidale?
Well, I'd been retired for a while, and we were living on the Darling Downs, which was, and we were about an hour's north of Toowoomba. We were very isolated there, no real community, because it was a small farm block surrounded by cattle country. So we didn't really see a lot of people unless we went into town to buy something. We realised that we were missing community. And so in the back of our mind was the idea of selling up and moving on. And then we bought a caravan to just explore, which was wonderful. And we were here in Armidale and in the New England area, and the temperature here was mid-20s. It was the middle of summer. It was just perfect here. And we looked at the forecast for where we were going back home, and it was 39. And we thought, let's sell. So we went home and we talked to a real estate agent who was a friend of ours, and she told us what she thought she could get for us, and we were shocked so much. And so we gave it a try, and she sold it within 3 weeks. And so we came back to Armidale and looked at three houses, made an offer on the first one and missed it, and made a second offer and got it, and then we had to move. It's been a wonderful experience.
Was there a sense of community or a vibe that you got when you're staying in your caravan here that convinced you also?
There was nothing specific, but we had a mutual friend, Graham Nuttall, used to work with Tony Windsor here, and he now lives in Brisbane. But he's a good mate of a lot of my friends here now, in particular Jim Maher. And so the day that we moved in our new home here, Jim turned up with a cup of coffee and a chat and said, "Welcome." So that made us feel good. But I think it was just the sense that there was something about this place that made you feel like it was a good community to live in. And I found that since we've lived here, that it's a giving place. People just don't take all the time. There are a lot of volunteers in all sorts of ways who are offering their services around the place and who are building a community together.
Well, that's a good segue to the Threadshed volunteer thing that's going on, and you're heavily involved with Rachel at the Threadshed. So is this the first thing you've sort of jumped into volunteer-wise in Armidale?
Yes, and this was all Rachel's idea. She's been thinking about it, as she said to you, for many years, been researching the problem of textile wastes, and she came up with an idea for how to fix it. And this community is so receptive to good ideas that, you know, it happened, and it's working. And I mean, yesterday alone, there were 20 to 30 people at Threadshed on a Thursday.
So, yeah, I saw a Facebook picture. You had a whole group of women there around the sewing machines and basically learning how to use the sewing machine, obviously reducing the waste and thing to landfill, fast fashion. I think 200,000 tonnes a year goes in Australia to landfill. And it's all driven by this fast fashion and our desire to buy clothes and only wear them once or twice and then get rid of them.
Yeah. Another really important part of Threadshed, though, is the mental health benefits of sitting around and crafting together. Rachel had somebody come to do a television interview with her yesterday at Threadshed, and Rachel said, "Oh, it was pandemonium because people were laughing and having such a good time in the background." And I said, "That is what they're looking for. They want to hear that, you know, excitement and joy."
No, it's fantastic, and I wish you all the best, you too, and thanks to the Uniting Church for supplying the space, which is a great space, very welcoming space, and to the people of Armidale who donated, I think you got 12 sewing machines.
Yes, and we should also thank the Uniting Church, provided some seed money to help us get started, and the Rotary Club of Armidale and the Central Armidale Rotary Club are both supporting particular events, and the Armidale Regional Council is providing grants as well. So it's been a real community effort.
Well, I wish you all the best with Threadshed, but also your time in Armidale. Don't be a stranger. Come in again sometime and talk about, or Rachel, or both of you, come and talk about Threadshed and how it's going.
Yep, terrific. Thanks.
Thanks for coming in, Bruce.
Thank you, Herb.
And that's Community Spotlight.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM 92.1 FM in the car and at work for great tunes and community news.